Intermediate Court of Appeals is now in session. The Honorable Craig H. Nakamura, Daniel R. Foley, and Catherine G. Leonard presiding. Please be seated. Case number 28353, Albert Plus versus Zoning Board of Appeals for the City and County of Honolulu. J. Stephen Street and Reginald Harris for appellant Albert Plus. Dwayne Pang for appellee Henry Eng in his official capacity as the director of the Department of Planning and Permitting for the City and County of Honolulu. And Robert F. Miller for appellee Drew Inc. Hawaii. Argument on the merits.
Morning, everyone. Welcome to the Intermediate Court of Appeals. Can I have just the parties stand up and introduce themselves to the court, please? We'll start with the appellants.
Stephen Street and Reginald Harris on behalf of the appellant.
Dwayne Pang, the Corporation Council, on behalf of the Director of Planning.
Robert Francis Miller for the intervener, Drew Inc. I also have the intervener, John Blake, who's the retired Director of Land Utilization for both mayors, Fossey, and
All right, good morning. Parties ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Please do so.
We really appreciate the opportunity to be heard on behalf of the appellants in their long effort to bring credibility back to the public participation process in this application for a conditional use permit. Simply stated, we believe from the beginning the director has failed as a matter of law to support the findings that needed to be made in order to grant a conditional use permit. And more than that, what has happened in this process is that the public participation has been made into a useless exercise. The participants feel that they have absolutely not been heard and that the director has failed to account for the considerable testimony and submissions that were made that in the process. And that, in essence, the way the director has handled this case has left the public participation in it as a meaningless gesture.
Well, but in this case, isn't it correct that the director, in response to some of the concerns raised by the neighborhood, imposed conditions on the conditional use permit that address some of those concerns? So I mean, in that respect, weren't they responsive to some of the issues that were raised by the neighborhood?
I think that the best thing that can be said is that the director listed the concerns of the neighborhood and then essentially attempted to address some of them by after-the-fact studies to see. And frankly, the main concern by all of the neighbors was congestion, traffic kinds of problems. Because the narrow roads up there, anything that is going to bring more trucks up there, is going to bring more traffic up there, is a serious concern to the neighborhood, and for good cause.
Mr. Street, though, you know, and your brief also says that the DPP ignored the public opposition, but as Judge Nakamura said, they didn't ignore it, they acknowledged it and explained it. Now you're saying that they failed as a matter of law. What is the legal standard that we should be looking to define what the city has to do with the public's opinion?
I think that what the city ought to do with the public, and what's so clear in this case that they hadn't done, is leave the burden of proof on the applicant. And the city acknowledges at page 22 and 23 of their brief that they felt they were compelled to accept the representations of this applicant unless there was substantial proof in the record to the contrary. And I submit, Your Honor, that that just turns the process on its head because it shifts the burden of proof to the community at large to come in and prove that what the applicant has said is incorrect.
Is there case law cited in your brief that clarifies that that's where the burden of proof lies?
I think that there actually is a case, there's a case that came out after the time our briefs were submitted in December of 07, which was the matter of contested case, the water use permit in Kukui, that makes it very clear that the burden of proof there is on the applicant and that the administrative agency there erred in submitting, in shifting that burden to the applicant. Here there's not a question. I mean, they've admitted, really, that that's what they did, that, you know, the applicant came in with grand-sounding plans and not a lot of detail. I mean,
let me see if I can break it down. So one of the things we're interested in, obviously, is the standard by which we should review the circuit court's decision. My understanding is that generally in these kinds of matters, the administrative agency, DPP, has a great deal of discretion in exercising its judgment in terms of the ultimate decision on the permit requirement. I mean, do you agree that it's a discretionary standard of review with respect to the DPP's actions?
As to certain things, but I think that is the Supreme Court recently found in Save Diamond Head Waters case that I hesitate to talk about because I know this panel is much more familiar with the details of that case than I am. But essentially, the Supreme Court came back and said the director does not have the discretion to just change the conforming use or just to permit certain conforming uses. This case deals with an issue in finding number one on conforming use. Certainly that Save Diamond Head Waters case had a much more complicated issue with respect to the accessory use and whether that could continue to be a conforming use or it was a change of use than this case.
It seems to me in this case, what you indicated is the primary concern of the appellants is with respect to the traffic impacts on this particular neighborhood. And I take it that one of the criticisms is that the DPP accepted the applicant's assumptions regarding staffing, which in turn would affect what the traffic impact or how the operations would run. So my question is, as to that aspect of the case, what's the standard review? Does the DPP have some discretion in accepting representations being made by the applicant with respect to staffing or things that might affect the traffic impact of the facility?
Well, Your Honor, I think that it was incumbent on the DPP in its exercise of the protection of the community to look beyond just bare representations that were made by the applicant, particularly given the fact that the applicant says, I really don't know what the requirements are, but here's what our assumptions are. And then the DPP said, you'll have to get a license from the Department of Health, so we're going to leave it to them to worry about the requirements are.
My understanding of the record, though, is that there was some reference to the applicant having hired consultants who were experts or had experience in assisted care facilities, and based upon the information provided by the consultant, submitted the application. In other words, it wasn't a situation in which they just out of the blue said, here are the numbers. Is that incorrect?
I don't think that's a correct reading of the record, Your Honor. They hired Mr. Clegg, who admitted that he had no experience whatsoever in the running of a facility like this. And they had some consulting with who, it's not clear. Those people never testified.
There was a reference to Barbara Suzuki and
Blue Water Resources.
Blue Water Resources came in at the ZBA for the first time, I believe.
Well, but doesn't the ZBA, isn't the evidence submitted to the ZBA, isn't that part of the record? And isn't that something we can consider in deciding the case?
But is it something that the director considered in making his decision to begin with and supporting his decision to begin with? And, you know, frankly, we never had the reports from them as to exactly what the staffing was going to be. I mean, basically, the testimony was that we've done some consulting with these people when it wasn't altogether clear. But to rely on that, you know, non-substantive kind of a consultation on the part of the director in making his decision that he was going to grant this conditional use permit, I think doesn't rise to the level of substantial evidence upon which he can base the decision.
Mr. Street, is there a report by Blue Water Resources in the record before the court?
I don't believe so, Your Honor.
Is there testimony, expert testimony offered by Blue Water Resources in the
record? No, Your Honor. And not at the public hearing, not in the application process, and not even at the ZBA level. I mean, the only thing that we have is some reference to the fact that we're consulting.
In other words, aren't we reviewing the circuit court's review of the ZBA? So wouldn't anything that occurred in the ZBA be something that we could consider in deciding whether the conditional use permit was properly granted?
But we can.
Is the answer to that yes?
Yes.
Can we?
Yes.
All right.
But again, even then, it's not substantive testimony as to what the real requirements are. The director left that to the Department of Health to determine how many staffers are going to be there. And the land use issue was based on Mr. Clegg's decision as to how many cars are going to be coming up there, what kind of delivery trucks are going to be necessary.
In your view, how much information would be enough? In other words, an applicant is proposing to run an assisted facility. What are you saying that at minimum they have to put in at the application stage to satisfy the substantial evidence requirement that you're saying needs to exist?
Well, I suggest, Your Honor, that at the very least, the DPP should hold them to a burden of proof to demonstrate that given real staffing needs and the way that facility is going to be staffed and visiting hours and everything else, that the traffic situation isn't going to be increased to the extent that it's a real hazard to the neighborhood. And the testimony from the neighbors up there is that these are winding, narrow roads. Routinely, people almost get hit on the roads. Judge Clifton testified in the hearing that he almost got hit the morning he was in testifying at the ZBA because somebody came barreling
right
around the corner.
But focusing on what they're required to put in. So in other words, say in this case, they say, we got consultants, we got together, this is the staffing requirement. Obviously the facility is not running, so they can't tell you in advance exactly what the requirements are going to be. Does the DPP have some discretion to eyeball the application, and as long as it makes some sense in terms of staffing requirements and whatnot, don't they have some discretion to say, okay, that's substantial evidence to support the application?
I think in light of the almost unanimous public concern over this issue, they needed to give it a harder eyeball than what they did in this application process. Because the applicant clearly said he didn't really know what the staffing was going to be. I mean, we pointed out in testimony before the ZBA that some of the assumptions that they made were clearly wrong. I mean, they had staff members working 15-hour shifts that supposedly aren't going to transfer in the middle of the night. They had probably inadequate staffing, or they underestimated the number of trips and people that were going to be visiting. Part of the public interest in having a facility like this is so that family members can come and visit, and yet they've got a program that's set up that their participants aren't going to be able to have people visit them after 5 o'clock at night. I mean, what the public pointed out, and I think what the DPP refused to really even look at, was the rationality of some of the things that they were proposing.
Mr. Street, assuming that you're correct and their assumptions were erroneous, like no one would visit these 16 people after 5 p.m., that you wouldn't need any large trucks on this road, that there really wasn't adequate parking, assuming that these assumptions were incorrect, what remedies would be available to the community after this permit is conditionally approved?
That's the real crux of the problem, Your Honor, because they recognized enough that there was a traffic concern that they imposed this this reporting requirement for what the traffic situation really was like. Not that we necessarily get a good report from the applicant himself, but they imposed this condition on them to report about how much increased traffic and complaints and so forth and so on after the fact. But I ask you, after the fact, what are they going to be able to do about it, assuming that the traffic is much worse? Three or four people have gotten hit on the road. The trucks are always blocking the traffic because they're serving three meals a day up there. They've got a little restaurant.
So are you telling me there is no restaurant?
I'm saying that if the DPP then says, okay, we're going to revoke your CUP, the applicant would be in here saying, wait a minute, you should have had me do this study beforehand, before I had invested all this money in building this place and renovating and putting the people here. You can't take this away from me. It's a vested right. And I'm suggesting that that's just not the way the process ought to work. The DPP ought to make them prove that it's not going to be a traffic problem, that it's not going to change the character of the community by virtue of the fact that there are going to be trucks coming back and forth. They say there are not going to be a lot of trucks coming back and forth, but where's the food going to come from to serve three meals
a
day?
So what information would you require? In other words, you would require them to put on evidence from someone who has experience with this kind of facility and say, this is the staffing requirements, this is how many deliveries are required. Okay, assuming they do that, then the DPP would still have the discretion to decide whether or not that was sufficient.
Well, and if the DPP had that kind of evidence and could support a finding that that was not going to have an adverse impact on the community because of that evidence, if they had required them to do a traffic study with full knowledge on what it was that they needed to service a facility like this.
Well, but how could they do a traffic study, because the facility's not there? They would have to have gotten somebody else who had experience to say this is what the traffic impact would be. In other words, you can't do a traffic study before the facility is up and running at that facility.
Yes, you can. I mean, because all they would need to do is have accurate information on what kind of traffic was really going to be involved in a facility like that. And they could have presented accurate information on that from some other arch facility that is experienced with running this kind of thing. And then they could have had traffic engineers say, well, look,
did the appellee put on evidence that the assumptions made by the applicant were in fact erroneous? In other words, did they have their own experts come and say, or have some information from like-size assisted living facilities saying, no, you don't need six staff, you need 10. In other words, the numbers that they had provided were clearly out of the ballpark.
No, the DPP didn't do that at all. They just assumed that whatever the applicant said was correct, even...
No, no, did the people who are opposing come up with information that would suggest that the information in the application itself was way off base?
Well, but with all due respect, Your Honor, that's shifting the burden of proof to the residents of the community who are there as volunteers making, participating in this public participation process, trying to let their anecdotal evidence be known. Now, maybe it would have been a great thing for them to all band together and hire the traffic study to be done at the time of that public hearing, but no, they didn't do that. And they shouldn't have had to do that. That is the responsibility of the DPP to protect the public interest at large. And the public has done its part by communicating its concerns and its own evidence of the nature of that community. I submit to you, Your Honor, that at least three of those required findings are heavily dependent on the input that comes from the community, and that's the way it should be. And
so
none of those.
The community can veto the application.
No, I'm not saying that. I understand that it's not up for a vote, and it's not, 200-1, and the community wins. But I think that when it's 200-1. And the community has expressed a number of legitimate concerns that, have nothing to do with, I don't want a facility like this in my backyard. It has to do with the traffic that's going to be on a narrow roadway up there that's already hazardous, that's already a problem with bikers and joggers trying to use those roads to add that much more traffic for a for-profit enterprise there that's going to run a van back and forth 25 times a day and have whatever visitors they're going to have and have whatever delivery trucks are going to have to be there in order to serve them three meals a day and do their laundry and do the other things that need to be done to run a facility like this. And I suggest that the DPP just didn't consider those things, or if they did, it's close the barn door after the horses are out kind of remedy. We'll have them take a look at it and see, And the problem is, after that happens, the neighborhood's remedy is, I told you so, but Mr. Clegg testified, and the representative, Ms. Naur from the DPP represented at the ZBA that they'd never seen them withdraw a conditional use permit after it had been issued.
Mr. Street, is it your position that a group care home facility could never be in your neighborhood? Because
no.
Anyone obviously would increase traffic on those roads.
Well, maybe not one of this size. I mean, they don't even need a conditional use permit for an eight-person facility in that neighborhood. What they applied for was one of the largest ones in the state. I mean, there are a few that are 300 rooms and 40 rooms, but this was like number five or something in the whole state. And maybe putting a facility of that size in that neighborhood is inappropriate. And in order to grant a conditional use permit, the DPP needs to be able to find with substantial evidence all four of those criteria. It is not going to change the fundamental character of the neighborhood.
So your position would be that that particular neighborhood could not accommodate two different eight-person assisted care home facilities?
It probably
could. Because under the existing zoning, they could have two without any conditional use permit required at all.
It probably could accommodate two eight-person facilities. They'd have to be 1,000 feet apart so they wouldn't be on that same property. Under the land use ordinance. But
so they could accommodate two eight-person facilities 1,000 feet apart, but not one 16-person facility on a 73,000 square foot piece of property?
I think there's a difference in character in an eight-person facility than a 16-person facility. And it And it's the scale of the operation that makes the difference. It's the scale of the operation that means there are going to be a lot more cars coming to one place. There's going to be more delivery trucks to accommodate three meals a day for 16 people. I mean, they applied for 20, and that was what the original application was.
All right. You want to save some time for rebuttal?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor, judges. Just to get to the, I guess, the heart of the matter, the group living facilities are permitted with conditions in residential zoned areas. In fact, they're permitted in most of the zoned areas except business or industrial use areas. And these particular facilities include nursing homes, care homes, halfway houses, and in this particular case, elder living. Now, with respect to the 1,000-foot limitation that Mr. Street had mentioned, if this falls under the definition of family, they can have 8 individuals who reside there plus resident managers without a permit, without a conditional permit. So they would fall under the definition of family, and the group living facility minimum of 1,000 feet would not apply. So they could be sitting right next to each other.
Mr. Pank, could you please tell us what are the standards for approval of a conditional use permit, and who has the burden of proof in this case?
Well, with respect to the application, I think Mr. Street cited the Topless case. It's a few years old, and it indicated that when an applicant comes in and say, I'm going to minimize certain problems that are made open by the public, then the director must look at that to determine whether those conditions can be mitigated. The review of the Zoning Board of Appeal of the director's decision is pursuant to our charter, and it says it's based on whether he was arbitrary or capricious. And so that is a high standard, and that is consistent with the position that the experts, the Department of Planning and Permitting, should be given deference.
Right, but are there particular criteria that an applicant must satisfy in order for the director to approve a CUP?
Yes, there are. There's 4 items that they must meet before a conditional use permit can be approved. And I think that Mr. Street has named all 4 of them. I think we all named 4 of them, and they are. Let me get there. Okay. The first one is that it meets all standards of the land use ordinance.
Okay, and one of those is the residential development standards. Is that correct?
Yes, and that's the height, width, things like that. In this particular case, admittedly, the resident, the actual house did not meet current land use ordinance, but it was a non-conforming use. And because there was no exterior alterations, I think it was reasonable for the director to determine that.
What about the height, though? The report indicates that the setback was a non-conforming use.
Yeah, the height was also a non-conforming use.
Right, that wasn't in the director's decision, though.
I think it was on page.
Okay, but when we're going from a residential use of an existing home to reviewing a conditional use permit to expand the use, right, is close enough good enough on these development standards?
Yes, the land use ordinance also gives the director discretion. Section 21-2.90C says the director may grant conditional use permits by modifying the application, modifying district regulations relating to yards, landscaping, and lot dimensions. So it does give him the discretion to allow these uses in the areas. And in this, and for this particular property, it's a very large property with respect to the minimum lot size in that area. R10 is very unusual in the primary urban center, which is the Honolulu district.
It's Mr. Pang, did the applicant have any burden of proof on traffic congestion?
I think they have, I think the burden with respect to if the director had any questions, and I think the record would reflect that after the public hearing, the director sent a letter to the applicant saying, these are the issues that were raised in the public hearing. Please respond to them. The director took all of those responses, all of those comments from the public public hearing, and gave them to the public agencies, police.
But yeah. Is there a burden of proof? Was there a burden of proof? Because that's Mr. Street's yes. major point. Was there a burden of proof on the applicant to demonstrate what the traffic congestion would be as a result of this care facility? Did it have the burden or not?
I don't want to consider it a burden. I think the director is obligated to get his experts and look at it and determine whether remedial measures can be put in the condition to determine.
I'm taking that as a no.
Well, I don't want to consider it as a burden. That's why.
Well, that's a no.
Yeah, I mean, there's minimum requirements that have to be put in the application.
So you're saying the applicant did not have a burden of proof?
Yes, they met the minimum application requirements.
Let me ask you this, though. There, what I hear Mr. Street arguing is that your land use impact decision is based upon assumptions provided by the applicant about what the needs of the facility was going to be. All right, but was there any substantiation that the assumptions of the applicant about the staffing requirements and the other delivery requirements, who's going to visit after hours, is there any substantiation in the record that those assumptions are accurate? Because if those assumptions are inaccurate, then your land use impacts are being based upon a false premise.
Well, I don't think that they are assumptions. I think the applicant says, the applicant provides us with assurances.
Based on what? Their word? I mean, is there something that they have to show that their assumptions are reasonable or they're supported by some consultant who has experience? Yeah. Or is there anything in the record that indicates that there is anything beyond the bare assertion of the applicant that its assumptions regarding staffing and whatnot are accurate?
After the public hearing, and there was an open house, and as you indicated, the record reflects that Ms. Suzuki was their consultant with respect to the adult residential care home. She answered all the questions with respect to the director, and the director sent the matter, the application, and all the comments to the Department of Health.
Right, but my understanding was that a Department of Health feasibility study was not a precondition for approval, that it was a subsequent condition.
That's correct, because, I mean, what do you get first? You get the state permit, or do you get the land use? Most people get the land use, otherwise can't have the facility.
Okay, there. But therefore you did not have the benefit of the Department of Health's feasibility study for the number of parking spots, the number of staff, the...
But the parking is determined by the land use.
Right, but I guess I'm thinking about number of employees, ergo number of parking spots.
Let me show this. In other words, say that the applicant said, we need 10 staff, mm-hmm. and the Department of Health grants a permit that says you need 15. What could the Land Use Commission do at that point?
Well, parking is
what,
not...
What could you folks, the DPP, do at that point?
Well if the conditions substantially change, it's one of the conditions in there. If you don't get your permit or there's other requirements, the permit can be modified by the director.
Okay, but in my scenario, has the conditional use permit already been issued? In other words, you're saying you still, one of the conditions is you have to get Department of Health approval. All right, but when they go to the Department of Health, they get approval, but the Department of Health requirements exceed the staffing information that the DPP got. Right. Is the permit already issued?
The permit's already issued, but I have to clarify, parking is not based on the number of staff.
I'm talking about parking, because the number of staff also affects traffic and affects other things too. Right. The impact, the land use impact of this particular facility is dependent upon some of the assumptions that are in the application, correct?
Right.
So I guess my question is, what if those assumptions are wrong?
Yes, and the director will look at those. And the director has a standard, if they substantially change what he has already decided, then he has a chance to go in and make changes or put additional conditions.
Does the public have any input on that?
I think the director has. No, if there has been a public hearing, there will be another public hearing if he reopens the conditional use permit.
do they have any ability to require the director to reopen the, in other words, if they feel that they, there are substantial changes in the assumptions that the conditional use permit or the conditions under which the conditional use permit was granted, can the public request some review of that situation?
Yes, and it has happened. The director has gotten complaints or comments, and he's looked into it and has reopened and modified and actually revoked.
Is that based on some kind of regulatory or statutory right?
Yes, it's a DPP rule, and it's put in most of their discretionary permits, and it's in this discretionary permit, and it's also put in there because, like you said, the traffic will be done when the facility is up and running, and I think the traffic review branch wanted to make sure that the roads are sufficient, and if they're not, maybe the city has to widen the roads, not necessarily the applicant.
So what is the basis of the DPP's determination that there's no significant traffic impact on this community? What is the factual basis? Or
I don't think that they said it is no significant impact. I think they took into consideration, and that's why they wanted to monitor it. They increased the parking. They took the assurances of the applicant that there would be no cars for the residents, and that bus passes would be...
But no cars wasn't a condition of the permit, was it?
It was an assurance from the applicant, and I would personally think that if an applicant makes false statements, that the director can open up the condition use permit and revoke it.
So what could the community... So if the neighbors in the community found that three of the residents have cars and they're going in and out, what is their remedy?
They can send a letter to the Department of Planning and Permitting, and basically I think that would be discovered in the traffic study.
And
traffic monitoring.
I'm and sorry. The permit could be
modified or revoked, yes.
Once, even though the facility is up and running.
Yes.
Has that ever happened?
Like I said, there was one conditional use permit in Waikiki that was revoked. It was a small one, admittedly, but I do recall that one, my personal experience.
Now, okay. In this case, is the facility up and running, and have those traffic studies been done?
I'm not sure. I'm not the property owner. I don't think so. I think they wanted to wait till this matter has been completed. Thank you.
Judge Nakamura, other judges, Robert Francis Miller, appearing for Through Inc. I'll try to answer some of the questions that you've raised, if I may. First off, we did have expert testimony from Mr. Clegg, who had been involved in previous applications for ARCH 2, applications of this nature, both with the Department of Health and also within the city side. I just want to clarify that unless
his testimony address the reasonableness of the information or the assumptions provided by
I believe that it did, and he also referenced the consulting capacity that they'd had with various potential operators for the existing facilities, people who were presently operating facilities that they had consulted with as potential contractors or operators for the facility. Clarify the record. Facility has not been operating pending this appeal, so it's basically been on hold because we're talking about substantial renovations inside the house, nothing exterior, in order to accommodate this. So the applicant is reluctant, you know, to go forward to make those kinds of financial commitments and then have the possibility of a reversal. But I want to clarify that expert testimony was presented at the director level and also at the ZBA level. Now, you're correct that staffing needs issues are representations. There are certain assumptions, presumptions, depending on the number of people and the existing 24/7 activity that takes place. So there were calculations made about delivery trucks when we say, for example, delivering clean laundry, taking away old laundry for clean bedding. And you do that once a week. Food storage, the food was not being prepared someplace else and brought in. The food's being prepared there. So we talk about establishing menus, having food dropped off. All this is shared with the department. The department listened to the concerns of the community regarding the traffic issues. So that's why the conditions state that there are only certain times that these things can be dropped off. There's also
Industry studies that have, I mean, studies of care facilities that would give you sort of ballpark figures as for, you know, this number of residents and this type of service, this
well,
is what
and I suggest to you that Mr. Clegg did provide those assurances or those representations to the DPP staff members who are conducting investigation, which is all part of the decision making for the DPP director. Now, also, I want to point out that here you have this proposed use, and what we're talking about 16 people on a 70,000 plus lot, a almost 10,000 square foot unit. They don't own any individual cars there. We're talking about senior citizens who are at a stage of their life where they're not no longer operating vehicles, and part of the condition for us is that they can't have cars because we don't want to assume any liability for them operating cars.
So that is a condition of the conditional use permit?
I don't think the director specifically said that, but I know we made the representations to the director that was part of our agreement, and if the court wants to modify an order and say that, we don't have a problem with it. Okay, we didn't object to it. Mr. Street asked for it, I think, before Judge Hefo, and we didn't object to it there because that's a representation that we've made.
She crossed it out for some reason. Do we know why it was crossed out those?
Well,
those
I don't
conditions?
Think she. I don't know. I can't tell you what's in her brain, but I mean, I just remember what she said, which was she was either there basically to affirm or deny the director's decision, and I don't think she felt comfortable adding conditions to the director's decision. I don't think she felt that was in her purview. You asked about the legal standard, Judge. A standard of review for the circuit court, and I'm going to try to go fast on this, but the case is Curtis versus Board of Appeals. It's a Supreme Court decision, 978 Pacific Reporter. And in essence, the standard of review is one in which the court must determine whether the circuit court was wrong, right or wrong, in its decision, applying the standard set forth in HRS 91-14G to the agency's decision. This court's review is further qualified by the principle that the agency's decision carries a presumption of validity. An appellant has the heavy burden of making a convincing showing that the decision is invalid because it's unjust and unreasonable in its consequences. And I submit to you, Mr. Street has not done that. Now, in the cross-examination process of the ZBA hearing, a key witness for Mr. Street first admitted that she hadn't even read the decision when she was testifying. Secondly, she admitted that the problem here was not that the director ignored them, because clearly he had conditioned his decisions based on concerns that they'd raised, but he just hadn't gone far enough. And going far enough means denying the CUP.
Does the applicant have an initial burden to meet certain criteria to be granted a conditional use
permit? I believe
permit?
That he does, and I believe that Mr. Pang pointed you to the four criteria that he had cited in his brief earlier. And I submit to you that I think that the applicant did, in fact, present information to support to the CUP application. Now, let me just also say that as part of this process, all the other city agencies are involved. So when this application comes in, it goes to the Traffic Bureau, goes to HPD, it goes to Emergency Medical Services.
Let me ask you this, though. Does the information, when this request was made to the agencies, do they have the concerns identified by the neighbors, or is it just based on the application itself?
Well, and on the traffic review issue, I think definitely they did. There's testimony in the record cited in our brief that the DPP person who was responsible for this said that she had made the concerns of the community, the traffic concerns, the 200 residents, made that information available to the traffic review branch. And they came back basically saying they couldn't, that this was de minimis. You know, that the quote unquote alleged impact issues as was being described just did not vet out in terms of their experience. Same thing with HBT, EMS, fire department. So none of those people found there was any concern here. Now, also, an issue came up about noise, emergency vehicles, that kind of a problem. Like, my God, we're going to have these senior citizens up there, and there's going to be you know, sirens roaring around all at all times or night and so forth. Well, we went back and presented to the director the EMS response records for the area. And we took a 2.5 month time period and supplied him with the records, which is part of the record down below, which showed that there, yes, there was EMS activity in a particular given time period, but none of them went to any of the existing ARC-2 facilities in the area. And there were eight facilities, three on Oahu Avenue, one in all the Manoa area, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. One had eight beds, four had eight beds, and one had 80. And there was no EMS responses out of 283 responses for a 12-week period. None went to the ARC-2 facilities. So I'm only thing I'm trying to point out there is there wasn't any emergency vehicles going there, and nor was there anything indicating any traffic problems for an ARC-2 facility. Nothing in the record to suggest that. And I would submit to you that at the ZBA level, the burden of proof is on the applicant there to show that the director has acted in an arbitrary and capricious manner. And I would have submitted to you that I would have been appealing decision based on if the director had said, well, 200 community members don't want this, so therefore I'm not going to give it to you. Well, I would have been appealing that decision because that would have definitely been arbitrary and capricious. If my existing land use allows me to have the particular usage, which it's clear by state statute, you'd be discriminating against me if you said I couldn't have a senior citizen facility.
Mr. Miller, before we get to that, now I understand that on this 73,000 square foot property, you could have two single family homes.
That's correct.
And
but instead, we have just one two-story facility that's about 9,000 feet.
Right, and eight adults, can live in an ARC in a single-family home.
You can have family-related members, ma'am. There's no limit on them at all.
But eight or fewer persons can live in an adult residential care home.
That's correct.
But then it's the next step that I thought was maybe a little bit of a leap. Eight is okay. Two houses is okay, therefore 16 in one house because it's a big house is okay?
Ma'am, let's look at it this way. On a 10,000 square foot lot, that a house that's approximately maybe 3,500 square feet, you can have eight senior citizens living in that right next to another house in Kahala, for example, Manoa. They're doing that right now. This particular facility is on 70,000 square feet, has buffers, I think it's 5,000 square feet in one direction of just a lawn garden towards Eva, has 3,000 on the other side, a 3,000 square foot towards the Diamond Head side, okay, which is a garden pathway area that the citizens or early senior citizens can use. There's nobody close to this facility. I mean, there's nobody close to this house. It's almost 10,000 square feet on the roof. Now, I would submit to you, if you could have eight people in 3,500, what conceivably would be the barrier to having, say, 16 at almost 10,000 when it's on a 70,000 square foot lot? So there's nothing that's going to go on inside that house which is going to have any kind of an adverse impact on an existing neighbor.
Did the applicant have a burden of proof concerning traffic congestion?
No. I think what the applicant had a burden to do was to provide information to the director. If concerns got raised, to respond to them, then it was up to the director to take that to the other city agencies that specialize in traffic matters to see whether or not they thought this usage was going to be in any way impair the existing road network or be a health or safety concern. And that's what they did.
Now, I'm kind of interested in how, in terms of the ZBA proceeding.
Let me just tell you, give you a little bit of bias here. I was the chairman of the ZBA for about 10 years.
All right, good. So you can tell me the answer to this.
Answer it, I hope.
If there is evidence presented at the ZBA that was not available to the director when the director made the decision, is that something we can consider in deciding whether the director's decision or in our decision in this case? In other words, is that something that we can look at to see whether or not the director's decision was not arbitrary or capricious?
Let me tell you, as a ZBA chairman, as a general rule, you don't exclude anything. You allow all evidence to come in, whether it's admissible, probative, whatever it is. But technically, a grounds for appeal would be if I were to allow in evidence that wasn't presented to the director, then technically, if I make a decision based on that, it's not fair to him. Okay? Because I'm taking in not law now, but evidence that he hasn't considered. So in the past, if there was evidence presented of that nature, we could remand the decision back to the director based on the new evidence, ask them to consider it, and then come back to us. That was the procedure that was available to us. Or we could exclude the evidence and just not allow it at all, saying that's outside the record. The ZBA can only review what's in the record that was before the director. And I would argue that you would sort of be in the same boat, because, I mean, how can you make a decision whether or not he made an arbitrary or capricious decision if you're looking at something that he didn't even have before him?
Thank you.
I don't have much time left, Your Honor. But I guess I just want to say that this is a large property. It's a beautiful property. And it's what the applicant is trying to do is to make it available for senior citizens, for people that are still ambulatory. I mean, we're not talking about people that are so sick that they have to have 24-hour nursing care. It's nothing like that. But it's for folks that are at a stage in their life where maybe they don't want to live with their families. They still want to maintain a level of independence. They have the financial resources to do it. The reason why the hours are set the way they are is because these people do eat together at a particular time. So when you say, well, family members can come and stay up until this point, and occasionally they may stay and have dinner, but normally, because they're as a unit, you're taking care of them as a unit, everybody's on a schedule as a unit. So therefore, you know, that's why when we say, well, people will visit during the day, not in the evenings, we tried to, the director said, well, okay, we'll limit, the amount of the deliveries and things so it's not in peak hours. So when you say people are going up and down the hill traffic-wise, we're putting a condition on you, don't get within those peak hours. And other than that, I went through all of this, and quite frankly, I thought the director did listen to the community's concerns, did impose conditions as a result. I didn't see here anything at the ZBA to suggest that he wasn't being thoughtful, careful in his decision-making. When we went before Judge Hefel, I mean, the same arguments were made. And it almost became a point of like, well, if 200 people in the community don't want it, it shouldn't happen, no matter what your rights are as a property owner. And that left a taste in my mouth of, well, this is mob rule. If I get enough people say no, don't do it, then the city administrators are not supposed to follow the law or the judge. And I would just say, when you look on this record, I think the presumption for the directors in his decision, the presumption for the agency, all of the agencies involved, the presumption of Judge Hefel, her decision, is such that the appellant just has not met their burden of proof, showing you that as a matter of law, they're wrong, because that's what you'd basically be saying. You're saying the city agencies are all wrong, Judge Hefel's all wrong. I mean, that's just not the case here. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. The LUO at section 21-2.9 B clearly says the applicant must demonstrate that the proposed use meets all pertinent standards. I think it's clear in the ordinance that the applicant has this burden of proof to demonstrate. And there's a reason why this process is set up to give notification to the neighbors, presentation to the neighborhood board, public hearing, and then the director has to take that application and determine as a matter of law that the applicant has met his burden in making four different findings. And the first of those findings is that it complies with the land use ordinance. And I think that the director has just kind of blithely said, yeah, but it's still a residence and we're not going to change the residence. So we can ignore that standard. I mean, that standard says that if it's non-complying use and they're going to change the use, which is what they're doing, I mean, otherwise they wouldn't be here for a conditional use permit. And standard number one that the director has to find, that's one of his requirements, is that it meets the LUO.
And it doesn't. Your argument is that even though it was conforming, it's a non-conforming use because it was the height restriction was okay when the house was built, but now it's no good. That because it's now it's in violation of the existing standards, they could not as a matter of law grant this application.
That's
unless they reduce the house by 3 feet.
That's what one of the required findings is, and I think that.
So you know, even though in a normal situation the DPP could overlook or could give a variance or whatever to even an existing house that violated existing height restrictions in this circumstance, they could not grant the conditional use permit.
He has specific authority to go ahead and grandfather it in if it continues the use that it was, even though they changed the standard, assuming that it was legal when they built it.
So you agree that it was conforming when built?
It was conforming when built, or at least certain portions of it where there were sheds and so forth that they didn't
but
have
the
buildings.
Height restriction, the setback.
The height restriction was, as far as I know, conforming, and the setbacks were conforming. I mean, that's what the director found. But he said, but, you know, since it's going to still be a residence, we're not going to make them knock 3 feet off the roof. But what I'm saying is, in order for him to grant this conditional use permit, one of the specific requirements is that he finds that it complies with the land use ordinance. And it doesn't do that. And he doesn't have the discretion to just waive that under this statute. He needs to find that it complies, that the setback requirements comply, that the height requirements comply. That's one of the findings he needs to make.
Mr. Pang argued that the director had the discretion to modify those conditions. Is that not correct?
And I, you know, I think he made, I think they made that argument in the Save Diamond Head Waters case in a lot more complicated situation than this, where it's a lot easier to find that he had discretion to make those kind of modifications there. I mean, here I think it's very clear that he doesn't have the discretion to do that. He has a required finding that it complies with the current land use ordinance. So if they're going to change the use, he can't just ignore the fact that it violates the setback regulations or it violates the height regulations. That's just one of the findings that, and frankly, that's the finding that's least tied to the issue of the public perception of this thing. The other three findings all go directly to the kinds of things that the neighborhood input is important to, including whether there's a need for this facility in this particular location in this neighborhood. I mean, they took that because it's elderly care. I mean, albeit elderly care for people that can afford $90,000 a year for their housing and are too elderly to drive cars but are not impaired in their health. I mean, people over 60 like me, I guess, but it's going to be a long time before I want to give up my car. But I think that what they failed to do really is take into account the public input as to any one of these findings. And the Hawaii Supreme Court has said that this decision can be overturned if it's clearly erroneous, and it's clearly erroneous if the record lacks substantial evidence to support the finding or determination. And frankly, that's any one of those findings. And I don't think they have substantial evidence to support any of the four findings. They certainly don't have support for finding number one, which is that it meets the LUO. And by virtue of that, I think this decision should be overturned and remanded back to the director to fully consider this application and honor his obligation to consider both the public input and the burden of proof actually being on the applicant rather than the community itself. One further thing, they made a comment about all of the public input being presented to the traffic division. I think they've done that by omitting a quick question in the middle of the testimony where Ms. Naur was asked what was submitted to the traffic bureau, and she said the application. Thank you very much.
Court stands in recess.